are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
So, looking over your bio, it says here, and this is a serious question that I have for you. It says that you're able to make a career out of acting like an idiot and refusing to grow up.
Yes. So
my question is, has it come natural to you to act like an idiot, or is that part of your acting?
At first, it was just my natural idiocy and stupidity, you know, stupid and idiocy in the land of the fool. I ended up becoming a professional clown. So
yeah,
it relates to that. But I think my spirit was kindred with the clown spirit. So at first it was somewhat, to my mind, unintentional and unacademic. But then the more I studied theater and got involved with physical comedy and clowning, I realized that, you know, I was attracted to that style of performance for a reason.
Yeah. When you were young, were you like the class clown?
Yes. I mean, I was very shy and timid, like around family and in groups and stuff like that. But when I got with a small group of classmates, I was class clown for sure.
Yeah. Interesting how I hear this so often from people, and I'm one of those guys. I'm actually kind of shy on the front of things. And yet the bodybuilding, you know, I'm out in front of people in bikini underwear performing, but yet at the heart of it, it's like, I'm actually pretty shy, you know, sort of by nature. It sounds like that's where you came from too, right?
No, well, it depends. I mean, I the older I got, I definitely became a complete extrovert, but I mean, yeah. I remember being a kid and being very shy and nonverbal around, you know, mostly adults and family and stuff like that. I was not funny in my house. Yeah. I don't think. Maybe I'd have to ask my parents. Maybe they'd say different. But I was conscious of it when I was around a few classmates. And then once I got my first couple laughs, I was off to the races.
Yeah. Maybe your parents, kind of like with my wife, when I was bodybuilding, I was huge back then. And she never saw me as being big. And she was just around me too much. So I wasn't that guy, you know? I go outside in public and it was different. It sounds like maybe that's what was going on with your mom and dad.
Maybe. Could be.
Yeah. So when did you know that you wanted to get into show business, I guess?
It's weird. I have this vague memory of... I remember I was in a car, I don't know where I was going, and I remember thinking that I should be a talk show host. And then I'm talking really young, like 10 years older, younger.
Wow.
And in subsequent years, I had no interest in specifically that kind, you know, that kind of entertainment, the kind of smarmy talk show host or anything like that. You know, I had some key moments when I was a kid where I made large groups of people laugh and I kind of perked up, but I definitely was of a comedic type, but I don't really think I understood about applying it to, you know, a discipline or anything like that and potentially a profession until high school, college.
Okay.
Probably high school, late in high school.
So would you say like your comedic, the things that you did, was that like as a part of being in a play, or were you doing already stand-up?
No. Just being complete irreverent idiot on my own. I mean, one of the first times I really made a lot of people laugh and adults laugh, I was around 10 years old, 10, 11, almost 11. And we were doing, it was at a summer camp and we were doing like these paper bag skits. Do you know what that is? Where you group of kids get a bunch of stuff in a paper bag. You have to make sense of it and make a little skit out of it.
Right.
And somehow it fit into whatever objects we had. I was like, well, I'll do an impression of Julia Child and I'll cook. Maybe we had a rubber chicken in the bag or something. I don't remember.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that impression and people went nuts. So I guess that was pretty
good. That's like impromptu, right?
We didn't know what we were going to say. It was just like, okay, we'll do this, we'll do that. Then I'll do the Julia Child thing. And then, you know, and the whole thing took, you know, probably 5-7 minutes.
Yeah.
And I had like a minute and a half of it or something. But I killed, you know, I totally demolished. And people, I remember especially counselors were coming up to me for days where, and were like, wow, great job, man. And yeah. I'm like, what, really?
Yeah. So did that give you like some kind of a charge, you know, from hearing people laugh at the things that you were doing?
So many years before I became someone who would consider himself a performer. But I mean, I guess in the back of my head that I knew I could rely on myself in that way, and that I wouldn't, that I had some, I guess, talent.
Yeah. Amazing. I know I used to get that feeling from, you know, I was an athlete and from playing games when people, you know, you made a play, you heard the crowd, you know, yell and scream for you. If it kind of sounds like that's what was going on with you, I'll tell you what, and you, I'm sure that you may agree with me, that kind of, when you get that kind of feedback, it's pretty addicting.
Yes.
But how did you take that? You know, obviously you didn't kill it every single time. So how did you deal with the other side of that?
It's horrible.
It's horrible, right?
I mean, at the same time, I started, you know, I was in plays when I was a kid, but I didn't want to be. Just everybody in the class had to be in one. And I always had one line and I didn't really care for it. But when I started seeking it out as a teenager, you know, my junior, senior year in high school, I was also delving into music. I was learning guitar. I was writing songs. I was beginning to sing in front of people. And so I started to pursue both of those things pretty seriously in college and then after college. And I made a decision fairly early on to not pursue music professionally, because the rejection from that when it didn't go well was so much more painful than not getting an audition or doing an improv scene and people wouldn't laugh. Somehow I could throw that away immediately and not be, you know, crippled by it. Whereas if my band played a gig and we didn't get a response, it really made me depressed. So
that's interesting. You know, it's funny how you know, those two things are, I mean, you're still kind of performing.
Yeah.
And yet one bothers you way more than the other.
The music was all personal though. I mean, it was, you know, mostly my, you know, my songs. And so like that being rejected rather than me doing a monologue of Shakespeare, whatever. Next thing. I mean, and you know, as an actor, you audition for a million things and you get three of them, right?
Right.
And as a musician and a singer-songwriter and being in an indie band, you're only just putting out yourself,
right,
constantly. And it, you know, you're not, I guess you are doing covers sometimes, but I was gonna say, cause like as an actor, for the most part, you're reading other people's words. But I just, even though obviously acting is deeply personal and it delves into your emotions and stuff like that, for some reason it didn't hurt as much for the rejection. I don't know. I mean, that's not to say that I haven't been hurt by rejection in this world, but I remember making a clear choice.
Yeah, I understand that. And how I can relate to you is, and the key word here is personal. When I played football in front of a crowd, I was with other players. When I was in bodybuilding up on that stage, if I didn't make the top three, that was a lot more personal. You know what I mean? I think I understand what you're saying about that, because that is a distinction. You know, you're performing in both of those examples just like you were, but I understand that now. You know, you took that personal.
Oh yeah, much more so.
Yeah, you know, I tell you what, when I love watching stand-up comedy. I'm amazed by those comedians. I think they're really brave. And it takes a lot of nerve to get up in front of a crowd like that and be the only person standing up there and to try to make people laugh. And when you bomb, I don't know if I can handle that, to be honest with you. I think that would destroy me. I don't know if I could bounce back from that.
That's why I don't do stand-up. I do improvisational comedy. And I'm much more comfortable in that. I'm comfortable doing it on my own, even by myself or with just one other person. But I really enjoy doing it with groups of people. And that's the thing, is that you're not alone. Like stand-up. Yeah. You're really on your own.
It takes a different muscle to be able to do stuff like that on your own like that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And amazing. Anyway, okay, so you go through high school and college. So when did like this start taking a sort of a different path for you? Because you've done a lot of stuff here that we'll get into, But when was that moment or that time kind of when things started shifting, would you say, as far as your acting career?
Well, I knew when I left college, I knew I was going to move to the Bay Area. And I was there because I was in love with the culture, having become a deadhead and really getting into that scene and the music. And I knew that they were from there and that they still were playing there at the time when I graduated college in the late 80s. Well, actually 1990.
That's Grateful Dead, right? The band?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But I also knew that, I wanted to try music and theater and that there were some theater troupes that I had heard about and seen and stuff like that, that were in the Bay Area. And I moved to the Bay Area to perform.
Okay.
And started doing improvisation and small theater companies and stuff like that and playing in a band. And, I just lived that lifestyle for many years and eventually started getting bigger and better parts. And after about 7 years, joined a local theater company that's quite famous for the area and even a little bit around the world, the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which did win a Tony Award in the 80s. And I became a member of that company. They do political musical comedy, despite their name, Mime. And so I was doing musical theater, like body, very physical style. We performed outdoors. And I became a company member and ended up doing lead roles in that part. Now that's a very fringe thing, but I was successful and at that, in that context. And did some other theater too in the Bay Area, Shakespeare and some other stuff. And then slowly started getting involved. I got an agent and would audition for commercials and small parts and TV shows. And every once in a while, would get a decent part in a film and stuff like that. It just sort of grew and grew. And then eventually, I mean, the biggest gig I had was beyond WandaVision, which I just did recently, was being a clown in Las Vegas on the Strip in a huge show there called La Rev at the Wynn Casino.
Okay, yeah.
It was akin to being in the company Cirque du Soleil, but it was a different company, but it was the same, pretty much the same people actually, and very similar aesthetic.
Okay. You know, what, listening to you talk, it amazes me because I'm lucky like you. I can feel your passion for what you're doing. Okay. It's amazing. It's amazing what one is capable of doing and tolerating when you have passion for what you're doing. And it's obvious, you know, the minute I listen to you talk, I know you've got that because I've been lucky with what I do. Everything I'm doing has been based on passion, and it just changes the whole perspective of everything, right?
Well, I think when you're involved in, like you, in your example, elite sports or the arts, you know, where, you know, if you don't have that, you're shot. I mean,
yeah, because you got to be all in.
I was just watching a playoff game. I'm a huge hockey head. I grew up playing hockey. And so I was watching, I'm in Massachusetts visiting my family, and me and my friends were watching the Bruins. And we were talking about, actually, I'm wrong. We were watching his kids play soccer. Sorry, his girl play, but we were talking about it in conjunction with talking about the game that we have watched or we're going to watch and stuff like that, and just in general. But like the passion that you have to have just on a single play, yeah, you know, or that you have to go for it to give your most at every second, especially in professional sports, or else yeah, you're not going to make it.
And you won't.
It's the same as an artist.
That's exactly right.
You're phoning it in as an artist. Doesn't matter what art, you know, what you're involved in. You're not gonna be noticed.
Yeah, it won't pass the smell test. That's for sure. And you won't be able to tolerate that. It'll break you down because you got to. What a lot of people don't understand is, you know, you seem to me that you've lived a really interesting and a fun life. But I'll tell you what, I don't know. I won't speak for you, but I'll speak for me. There's a lot of tough times in that highway to where you've gotten now to WandaVision, because you mentioned that one of your favorite ones, but there's a lot of rough road that you've traveled, right?
Oh yeah. I mean,
people don't get that.
I live, you know, people talk about being an artist and being poor and living on Top Ramen and peanut butter. And it's absolutely true. I mean, yeah. I wasn't into Top Ramen, but I, there were many, many days where I was lucky to scrape that extra wad of peanut butter off the bottom of the bottle so I didn't have to go buy another jar for that one day. And then, you know, you get a gig, buy some peanut butter, and hope for.
Yeah.
And I got really sick of it. It was really drudgery. And I almost quit at one point. I was really going to hang it up. And then I got cast. You know, I mostly done comedy. And then I got cast in a series of short plays, most of which I think I was in four short plays in this evening of five or six short plays. And one of them, the biggest one I was in, was very serious. And the other one, the other two were mostly dramatic. And that was such a great experience and so different than what I had done up to that point that I got reinvigorated. And right after that period, I got cast as a pretty significant role in a short, in an independent film. And then I got cast in the show in Las Vegas, which took me another 10 years. I was 9 years in Las Vegas working in the circus.
That's huge.
And by the time I left there, I was almost 50 years old. And that, you know, at that point, it's kind of too late to change.
Yeah. Let me ask you, it sounds to me like by nature, you're more, you lean more towards comedy, but when you're playing something that's more of a dramatic role or serious role, is it a lot different? Is it like a whole different, mindset that you need to get into to be able to play authentically a serious part compared to comedic?
Yeah, at its essence, you know, acting is acting. So it's like the basic toolkit is the same for both. Now, when you're talking about clowning, that's way different than your basic acting situation. But as far as—
Why is that? Why is that clowning? Why is that way different?
Because it's not realistic necessarily. However, you want to be rooted in truth and your emotions and your expression, but the character you're often playing, your clown, is not a supernaturalistic character. Everything is heightened. And there's probably a certain tone or emotion of your particular character that's blown out of the water. Like, you might be very childlike, you might be very mean, you might be very angry. Not that by any stretch of the imagination is that the only way a clown can be, to be one emotion, but your character might be really oversimplified, over stupid, too smart. Yeah. Just like, it's a world of extremes. And you play with those extremes until you come into balance with what the character is. And the other huge thing is that you're constantly dealing with the audience, which in theater, television, film, you're not. And within a clown's world, the audience is one of your scene partners. So that's very different sensibility. But in general, going back to the other thing, I think that when I do drama, even though I do play different characters, when I'm playing something more dramatic, I'm more closely related to who I am.
All right, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian power burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
One of the things that I asked you, I didn't know if you heard me, was that one of the things when I listen to these documentaries about bands, it seems one of the common themes is that it takes a while for a band to really know and learn who they are in terms of how they sound to make them unique. Would you say that as an actor, that is kind of the same way? Does it take a while for you to find out who you really are?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is that I don't try too hard. Yeah. I'm more relaxed in my way of going about it. And so that doesn't mean I work any less. It just means that maybe that I'm not trying to be perfect to a certain, you know, it depends on the situation. Obviously, when you're doing a physical routine, it needs timing and everything. There is a certain amount of perfection, but just sort of like a mellowed glass of wine. I'm sort of mellowed into the actor that I am.
Yeah.
I think it, because of that, I have more range than when I was younger and I was maybe trying really hard to do something. And
I was going to say, what that reminds me of is like when you're talking about a world-class sprinter, even though these guys are like, you know, they're going 100 miles an hour, they have to do that in a relaxed way. And it kind of sounds like what you're talking about, you know, when you're able to just kind of relax and just, you know, and not have to be so much worried about perfection. I think it almost comes off just a little more real, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I mean, the goal of especially improv, but also acting, is to be in the moment. You know, you want to come across as a living being that people think would exist. And so it's exactly like they say, like, you know, they say that Wayne Gretzky, that the reason he looks like he moves slowly, even though they're playing really fast hockey, because his brain, the way he sees the game and everything, I think he said that things slow down, and a lot of it,
exactly,
athletes say that. And that's for sure, you know, especially in improv, when I'm on fire, it's exactly like that.
I think in many cases, the slower the game slows down, the better you're going to be.
Yeah.
You know, and it happened to me, like, again, in bodybuilding, we're performing up there, but the first show that I did, hell, I don't, you know, we had like a minute and a half to do a posing routine, choreographed. I don't even remember the damn routine that I did. That was going so fast, you know? And then I compare that to the end of my career. It was like so much slower. I enjoyed the moment and the crowd responded to that. You come off much differently is what you're saying, for sure.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's always a certain amount of, it goes two ways and it depends who the audience is. But like, you know, when you're young and you're aggressive and stuff like that, there's a certain, especially, and you're performing, that can be good to a certain level, but there's a whole other thing. I remember I went and saw, my aunt is also an accomplished actress and she married an accomplished playwright, Lyle Kessler. And my aunt's name is Margaret Ladd. And he had a workshop production of one of his plays and Al Pacino was in it.
Ooh.
This was, you know, so it was a small thing, it was a small theater. And I could tell that Al Pacino was trying stuff out. But it was like, he was so at ease, just on the stage, in the work. Doesn't mean that his character was at ease.
Right.
But it was so interesting to watch. Like, he hadn't figured everything out yet. It was a workshop. And but man, just like every little thing. I remember commenting to someone that, you know, Al Pacino experimenting with farting would be amazing to watch. It's because he has so many tools in his toolbox. And
amazing.
It's like when they say someone can sing the phone book, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, In Italian fashion, they call making something that's hard look easy. In Italian fashion, they call that sprezzatura. You know, it's taking something that, you know, you look impeccably dressed. You put a lot of time into it, but you make it look so easy that top comes off.
Right.
I think that's when you're a real pro.
Well, that's what goes back to what you're saying, you know, about like the older performers and stuff like that. Doesn't work as well with athletes to a certain extent because their body breaks down. But
yeah.
There's nothing better than watching a person who can just come on stage and blow you away. I remember even I read, who was it? Crap. Some famous Shakespearean actor. Someone came up to him and said, that performance of King Lear was so amazing. What were you thinking about? And he was like, what I had to go buy at the store. Like, he was able to sort of phone it in a way that was still super professional and super high level.
Yeah, that's sprezzatura right there.
I think it's especially evident with, and I'm noticing this because I'm noticing a lot of stand-up comics who I've known for 20, 30 years, not personally, but have been watching, and they're really getting good now, right yeah. now, in their mid to late 40s, early 50s.
Beautiful.
So good.
Yeah.
Almost like they can do anything.
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, to feel like you have that command, I mean, I wonder how they feel. If they really feel like, yeah, I got this.
I think some of them do. The one, yeah, like, you know, Louis C.K., Bill Burr, David Spade is, I've been watching one of his shows lately. He has a late night. It's like an interview talk show, not a traditional format, more like pop culture stuff. But, you know, I never really vibed with him. I always thought he was funny, but I wasn't like a huge Dave Spade fan. Now yeah. when I watch him, really, he's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, I know what you mean.
He's got his little quirks and his little things that he relies on, but it's different when he's doing those things as a 25-year-old and now as a 50-whatever-year-old or whatever, however old he is.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, and you know, like in sport and in acting, in your line of work, you know, people who stay, who create longevity for themselves, they're amazing people because, you know, they've had to go through, and if you stay the same at 25 as you are at 45, I think you're going to be dead in the water in most yeah. cases, you know? And so for you to be able to be relevant as you get older and even get better, like you're talking about, that's amazing. You know? Tell me about Riviera. Is that the way you said you're acting? You're an acting coach and a clown act conceptor. What was all that about?
So, I left Le Rev in Las Vegas in 2016. And, you know, the circus is a very transitory profession. There are people who left my show and came back 5-6 years later to be employed again there. And sometimes, you know, obviously as performers, but then some would come back and be different functions of the team, like not even performing. So you see these people all over. And so it's not uncommon to float around and work with somebody and then work with them again 10 years later. So after I left, I got a call from a guy who I used to be in the show with, and he's Romanian, and he was back in Romania, and the place where he cut his teeth on doing, he's an acrobat, doing circus, had recently gone through some problems. There was a big fire in a warehouse, and they were a circus with animals, and they had animals that were living in the warehouse, and some of them died. Huge uproar. Everything changed at the circus. He was at this transition point, he was able to slip in and say, hey, let me direct a show that's more like this new Cirque du Soleil thing rather than the traditional old school Romanian circus, which hasn't really, you know, super evolved. I mean, things have evolved, but in a long, long time. So this was a state funded circus that came into being during communism. And like the style of the clowning was still harkening back to that style of clowning. And the shape of the shows and the type of music was all very, you know, for the most part, traditional. So he assembled a team of people from Le Rev and beyond who were all super professional and had worked in big shows like Le Rev, mostly Le Rev. And we moved to Romania for several months and created and put on a show. And my specific job was to sort of do acting coaching and ensemble creation with the whole cast, because we were going to be asking acrobats who normally, you know, these are like weightlifters. They don't have to be the best performers or be able to dance or emote necessarily. They come on and throw each other around. So I had to work with these people to try to get them to express themselves depending on what the creator of each act needed from them. And then I more specifically worked with another clown friend of mine, a British guy who I had met in Vegas and worked with in Vegas. And we put the clown acts together. So, and it was both a horrible experience and also a very rewarding and, you know, life-changing. And it was a sink or swim thing. Like, I was definitely over my head.
Yeah.
As far as what my abilities, especially with creating the clown work from scratch, especially with a bunch of guys who were not trained like me and who I was worried that they would be judging it. And
yeah,
very.
What about the language barrier?
A lot of them speak English.
Oh.
And I speak Spanish and Italian, or a little bit of Italian. And so I would bastardize, you know, because Romanian, it's kind of like a mixture between a Romance language and Russian. So it's, I mean, that's a very simplified way to describe it. But, you know, there's certain phrases you can get away with. And then, but really most people, even if they spoke very broken English, could make themselves understood. So,
yeah, you know, one of the questions I have is that in that line of work in the circus acts and all that you guys did, what is the lifespan of how long you can actually last in the industry? Because it seems like that's a pretty physical type of stuff that you're doing, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's about the same as an athlete. You know, I think, except for the fact that you can, like you'll find a lot of, in these Cirque du Soleil type shows, you'll find a lot of acrobats who, by the time they're in their late 30s, they're becoming characters, not acrobats. And they still may do something with flair, but it's going to be more, you know, choreographed than full-on acrobatics. And then even some of those guys, if they have a link to comedy, can become clowns.
Yeah. And
depending on who you are as a clown, you can either employ acrobatics or not.
Yeah.
So there's an 82-year-old guy in Las Vegas who still performs as a clown.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's very funny. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, talking about you were uncomfortable in that sort of the role you were in because you were coaching and acting, you know, as you probably, maybe this is what you're talking about, because what I learned, I played sports throughout my, you know, until I was in college, and I had coaches that were really good coaches, and I had coaches that just weren't. And the ones that weren't, they didn't have the ability to be able to tell the athlete how to perform the act or perform the play. They actually had to themselves, I remember one coach in particular, he would show us how to run the play, but he couldn't tell you verbally, this is how you have to do this. Is that what you mean about, you know, being uncomfortable? Because that's a whole different dynamic, being a good coach.
No, I mean, no. There was a lot of the bullshit of that job was working with the system that existed.
Oh.
Again, a former communist country, circus founded in a state circus under communism.
Got it.
The red tape, the, you know, well, that's not my job kind of attitude, you know.
Yeah.
And was very, very difficult. And that did, that the performers were involved in some of that frustration, that their attitude was just like, you know, those guys, they get paid to show up and either rehearse or perform. It doesn't matter what's going on. They get paid the same rate, and they are lifelong members of this circus, and their job is not in question. It's not in danger because of that system. Whereas we would come in and we were very intense and we're like, we got to perform at this high level. And they're like, doesn't matter what I do. I mean, you know, on the one hand, they wanted to work and they wanted to, and they're very hard workers. There would be things like, it was like, I can't come tomorrow. I'm painting my kid's bureau.
Yeah.
I have to change my tires today. So I'm going to be 2 hours late.
Oh boy.
Which in a Western world, that does not cut it. And so it was a bit of culture clash.
Yeah.
But then there was my inability, my lack of experience in working with people to create clown work, which is very hard to talk about because often the acts are nonverbal and you don't know what the act is until you get it in front of an audience. So to try to create something and to get people who come from a very more stilted, very zany kind of circus clown to be a bit more maybe Chaplin-esque, more subdued, still over the top and big, but more refined, more of a European style than a Russian style. The Russian style is very intense and moody and often over the top.
Yeah, interesting. I was over in East Bloc in the late 80s, I was in Bulgaria and Russia and Czechoslovakia at that time. Boy, I'll tell you what, I know kind of what you're talking about. You talk about culture shock. I was in big shock when I went over there because of some of the things that you're talking about. We, as Americans, sometimes we don't really understand a lot of things here.
I know. I actually had this major revelation when I was over there. Because, you know, when, looking at how communism affected that country and the attitudes that people have towards work or other things. And now it's been several years since I've been there, so I can't remember all the examples. But it enabled me to look back at my country and understand, you know, it was specifically thinking about slavery and racism. And I would think that people who don't get that, people in America, white people who don't think that we have an issue with race or that slavery still has its tentacles out on the culture. If you go and experience another culture that has had a long history of something that drove it, like communism, let's say, and then you see how communism still affects the culture, you can then maybe look back at your own country and go, okay, I could really understand this better.
Yeah, it gives you some perspective for sure.
Yeah.
Graeme of Thones. Is that like a spoof? What the hell is that? National tour.
Yeah. Well, you pronounced it exactly right. I mean, I would have pronounced that Graham, like the name Graham, which it is, but it's written in a British way, so it's supposed to be Graeme. And
sometimes I get lucky.
It was a takeoff of Game of Thrones, very Monty Python clowny version. And I was brought in as a replacement actor on this European company's national tour. And I had worked with the producer on a show in Vegas, Piff the Magic Dragon, who's a British.
That's on that too. That's kind of funny.
Do you know who that is?
No, but the spoof on that makes me laugh a little bit.
He came in second or third on America's Got Talent. He's a comedic magician, hilarious dude.
I'll be darned.
Does the whole act with a little chihuahua called Mr. Piffles.
I think I may have seen that.
Really funny, really funny guy, very droll sense of humor. Anyways, that his producer knew me and said, hey, would you take a look at this script? If you're interested, I can employ you for 2 weeks on this tour. So I jumped into the tour. It was a blast. It was so much fun because it was, like the Mime Troupe, which was a very physical, fast-paced style of theater, where often actors played up to 7-8 roles in a play. I think I played like 25 roles in this play. Now, granted, some of them were just peeking out from behind a curtain with a wig on, saying one line, then getting dressed and coming out as another character. So,
Would you guys stay in like a city for a few days or just do a show here and then take off and do all these?
I think that particular tour was one and done. But like, I think maybe if I'm not mistaken, we either did two shows in a day or two shows over two nights in New York City in a very small venue. I think it might've been two in one night, but mostly it was one night. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. What a life. Broadway LA. What the hell is that one about?
Broadway. That was a group that I joined right when I got to LA in 2016, and they exclusively did improvised musicals. So Broadway, like Broadway, but I guess fraud in that we're making them up.
Yeah, exactly.
So that group had been around for years and came out of, I believe, Acme Theater, which was a school and company that has since closed down. But it used to be one of the feeders for like Mad TV and stuff like that. They improv and sketch company.
Kind of just the stuff like that just seems like it just really ties in and gets into your creative side. I mean, it seems like you can expand on all this stuff a lot in different ways.
Yeah. Well, that group was really, when I joined them, at a really good time because they had been doing one or two shows for a really long time, like cycling back and forth, and they're improvised. So you can do them forever.
Yeah.
But then when I got there, we started doing things like we would do H.P. Lovecraft musical. We called it Cthulhuzical because the book Cthulhu or the place Cthulhu in that writing, Cthulhuzical. I love that we called it that. And then we did, I'm spacing out. the guy who did like a Nightmare Before Christmas? What was that?
I have no idea. Charlie, you know what?
Danny Elfman wrote the music for all of his movies.
Tim Burton?
Tim Burton, thank you. So we did Nightmaresical. Based on his style of movies, we did sort of a holiday-themed Nightmaresical, the Maresical being musical.
Yeah.
So those two shows were really, really fun. Just really crazy.
It sounds like it. I mean,
a musical version of H.P. Lovecraft, and we did it, and it made sense. That actually, the idea with those types of shows is to create an improvised piece, and in our case, a musical improvised piece. So with a live keyboard player, a really good keyboard player, and to basically create something that that person or that group of people may have actually written. So we really study the style and the themes and motifs and stuff like that. And we try to get costumes that match the style, and we really go for it.
Wow. The Shakespeare Festival, is that something now that is more, a little more serious?
Well, funnily enough, I did Shakespeare in college and I did it professionally, and it just so happens that I did the same two plays professionally that I did in college, different characters, and they were both comedies.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Midsummer Night's Dream and what was the other one? Come on, almost spacing out. God damn it.
Don't worry.
Twelfth Night.
Okay. That's funny.
But you grappling with the language is more serious. If you ever watched Twelfth Night or Midsummer Night's Dream, there's high comedy in them.
Yeah. Let's wind this up. You've done so much stuff. It's crazy. WandaVision. Does WandaVision, because Charlie's the one that's been talking to me about this stuff. I haven't seen Avenger. I don't know what Marvel is that much. I really don't. He's really introducing me to characters and people like you. So tell me about WandaVision and what's your role in that?
I played Dennis the Mailman. And the thing about WandaVision is that it's really one of the most creative television shows I've ever seen, and it really was a genre bending experience. And I, when I was watching it, I really felt like I was watching a TV show, you know, put together by punks, that they were looking at the system and looking at what a TV show is supposed to be, and they were just going, fuck you, you know, we're going to do what we want because this is cool. And yet it was a big corporate production by Marvel and Disney. So I'm amazed that it got made just because it's so out there. But I mean, if you don't know, I don't know a lot about MCU or the Avengers, but what Marvel Universe is doing, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is that they're taking all the different properties and they're mixing and matching them to a certain extent. You know, they're invading each other's realities. And then in this particular situation, the basic premise is that Wanda, the main character, is going through something, and she inadvertently creates this reality that sucks a bunch of townspeople who live there into the reality that she's created. So she basically creates a prison controlled subconsciously by her mind. That in itself is a very Twilight Zone-y weird thing. The way that it manifests itself is that each episode in this case takes place in a different style of a different TV sitcom from a different decade. So you've got like a Leave It to Beaver, Andy Griffith style. Then you've got Bewitched going into another 60s. Bewitched, can't think of one right now. Oh, Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh, wow.
Into the Brady Bunch, into numerous 80s sitcoms, et cetera. It just kept going on like that. Until the veneer of that reality started to bubble open and crack, very Twilight Zone-y again, and then the true sort of superhero aspect of those characters, but not for like 3 or 4 episodes, starts to reveal itself. And then you end up with a lot of action and insanity and evil people. But it's really a wild ride. I don't know if I did justice describing it, but that's it in a nutshell. And within that, because it's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they're referring to other vehicles that Marvel has created, other movies. They're doing weird things. Like there's been 2 depictions of Wanda's brother by different actors in different franchises. And they used the one that wasn't in the most recent Marvel movie or Avengers movie and took the other guy and put him in the role.
Wow.
It was very meta and weird. And I mean, I really respect the fact that they were, can you imagine that? It's like, you know, it's, do you remember on Bewitched when the Darrens switched?
I don't.
The husband character switched. They never mentioned it. They just switched them. But it was kind of like,
maybe I do remember that.
Yeah, but it's even more weird because by the act of doing it, they were almost like playing with the audience's sensibilities and stuff like that, and saying, "Look, we're Marvel. This is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We can grab and take people from where we want." Yeah. Very
kind of cool. Goes back to what you were saying. Fuck you. We're gonna do what we want.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to. I mean, I've talked to the director, of course, because I work with them, but I'd love to talk to the creators and understand if they felt like they were doing that. Did they feel like they were doing a big FU to the industry in a way, not an FU of like, we disrespect you, but like, we are completely doing this weird thing. And it ended up being hugely, insanely successful. And then hence I've got people like you contacting me. I have one of the smallest roles in the show. I was out of the recurring characters, I should say.
Yeah.
So it was very fun.
And you said you're Dennis the male, which character are you?
I'm the mailman, Dennis the mailman.
Dennis the mailman.
And with each decade, I might be a US postal worker or a more like a UPS delivery man. And then it field that I, in the real world, I wasn't any of those things. I was a lowly pizza delivery guy. That was really who I am.
Let's take a quick pause to tell you about something you're definitely going to want.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're going to get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian power burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
How long has this been going on?
It's over. I mean, it's on Disney Plus. There's 9 episodes and they'll be up there forever. And it was a limited miniseries. So as far as I know, there's not going to be any more. There will be other products with characters like Wanda in it, the main character played by Elizabeth Olsen. So the storylines that were dealt with in that will have further life. But I don't really think there's much, to my knowledge, any more work for me there. I mean, I'd love to have it happen, but I'm also very lucky to have been a part of it at all, because it's one of these massive, the Marvel universe is like Star Wars and Star Trek. The fan base is global and insane.
That's what Charlie's been telling me. You know?
Yeah, there are all these theories about, like, literally, like dozens and dozens and dozens of memes, podcast conversations, videos, reports, and just people talking about my character and what it meant that he was more than just the mailman.
Yeah. So what's in your future now? What's next for Amos?
I just am constantly auditioning And so there's that. I just got another email right before I logged on here from my agent to audition for something. And so I'm doing that. I actually, based on the crazy response to the character, like as far as what people thought he was beyond his limited job as a mailman, I kind of wrote a comedic love letter response to that to all the fans. And then I filmed a music video, and I'll be releasing that any day now. I'll send you the link when it's up, and you hopefully you'll share it with your followers.
Absolutely. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure getting to know you and getting to know more of what Charlie's been telling me about for a while about the Marvel and all that stuff. I really appreciate you coming on. Really good information.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet.
Talking to you.
You bet. Maybe we'll run into each other again
sometime. All right. Well, we'll be in touch. I'll send you that link.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.